Behind the Curtain with Jack Berkman.
And welcome to Behind the Curtain. I'm Greg Corumbus, filling in for Jack Berkman this week. A full slate of very important topics for you. A little bit later in this edition, we'll go behind the curtain and look at why so many cities are no longer all that interested in hosting the Olympics. It's also tied in with the fact that all those facilities that they built up in Rio de Janeiro for last year's Summer Olympic Games are already rotting away. Also, we'll take a close look at the 2018 midterms. What do we know so far about the attitude of voters and the way the different parties will approach the midterms, even though they're well over a year away? We'll also take a look at the staff shakeup that is supposedly happening at the White House. We've seen one resignation by the communications director. Is more coming? And what exactly would the shakeup look like? But first, we're going to take a look at the latest developments in the investigation about Russia, the Trump campaign, and any possible collusion. Because this week we saw a different twist on the story. And the different twist is that somebody from the Trump campaign wants to testify, and the lawmakers say, well, we're not quite ready for you yet. With that story is Melissa Quinn, breaking news editor at the Washington Examiner, who joins us now. And Melissa, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, the story you've been reporting on, and the Examiner certainly has been reporting on, is about Carter Page. He was a foreign policy advisor to then presidential candidate and Republican nominee Donald Trump, and he has certainly been among those names listed in the handful of names who might have had improper contacts with the Russians, and we'll talk about whether there's any proof of that going forward here in our conversation. But he's unique now in that he is desperately interested in testifying before Congress about what he knows and what he sees as incorrect statements or inaccuracies in recent testimony by CIA Director John Brennan and others, but the committee's apparently not ready for him. What exactly is going on here?
Yeah, that's correct. So Carter Page sent a letter on Monday to the Intelligence Committee, the House Intelligence Committee, saying that he is ready to come and testify and speak to committee members directly. What he initially said in his letter was that he had heard from committee staff that he actually may not be given the opportunity to do this. And just like you mentioned, he specifically wants to address the quote-unquote false or misleading testimony from former FBI Director James Comey and former CIA Director John Brennan. Now, just like you said, the committee actually came out, I believe it was earlier today, so not that long ago, and said that we will call people to testify at our own pace and when we want to. So whether or not Carter Page will have the opportunity to go ahead and speak publicly really remains to be seen.
This is a guy who was under a lot of scrutiny a little bit earlier in this investigation. So is this basically being read as the committee staking its claim as we're in charge of this investigation, we'll decide which witnesses are brought forward and when? Or is there a reason, perhaps, that suddenly this once critical figure in this investigation is no longer a priority?
It seems to be that the committee is really pushing back and saying that they will interview witnesses, you know, in a manner that they dictate, not necessarily. I wouldn't really read too much into how this plays into the investigation, but in there, what the committee said in response really didn't even mention Carter Page by name. You could just sort of put the pieces together. But they did say that they are anticipating interviews, to start shortly. We obviously don't have a specific date yet, but they did say that the committee is just going to be the one dictating how those interviews proceed.
You mentioned, I think they're just in passing, that the committee hasn't actually interviewed very many people at all at this point. What's the reason for the sluggish pace?
Well, that's correct. The committee has not started interviewing people, and we've seen that go on not only with the Health Intelligence Committee, but with some of the other congressional committees that are looking into Russia's ties to Trump campaign associates. So it's definitely not specific to this committee in particular, and we actually just heard a few minutes ago that James Comey is going to testify publicly before the Senate Intelligence Committee, but like some of the others, we don't have a date on that yet either.
So why is Carter Page itching to testify? Based on what he's revealed at this point, what does he have to say?
So this all really stems back to a FISA warrant that was issued, I believe it was last year. The FISA warrant was issued based on what we think, what's been reported, based on the Russian dossier that was put together by a 2016 former British intelligence agent. And what Carter Page is saying was that the information that is included in that dossier is inaccurate. Now, the thing that's important to note is that Carter Page specifically mentions James Comey and John Brennan in the letter that he sent to the Intelligence Committee, but he doesn't go ahead and actually list any falsehoods that neither Comey nor Brennan made against him. He's really talking about the press reports that are related to that compilation of memos from the British intelligence officer, saying that press reports are showing that authorities did, in fact, use this unverified information to go ahead and approve that FISA warrant against him. And just as an important reminder, the FISA warrant really allowed U.S. officials to monitor Carter Page's interactions during the 2016 campaign.
So his argument is essentially that the dossier was bogus, so therefore the justification for any ongoing surveillance of any kind was bogus.
Correct. Mm-hmm. That is correct. And, you know, it seems like he really just wants to get before the committee and push back on some of the allegations that were included. And again, with so many things up in the air, we'll see when that actually takes place.
What about the other side of this? Because at various times, actions of the Obama administration, of course, and we've just talked about one of them with the surveillance before the FISA court and getting those warrants okayed, is we've got the unmasking, we've got different types of surveillance. And then, of course, there were the reports last week that there was broad surveillance on American citizens, which were then shared fairly widely. So is that part of the scope of the congressional investigation?
It doesn't seem to be. Obviously, the congressional committees right now are focusing their investigation into Russia's meddling and interference in the 2016 election. And obviously, with that comes potential ties, or alleged ties, I should say, between Trump campaign associates and Russian officials. But just what you said, that point is actually something that Carter Page raises in his letter to the House Intelligence Committee. He is urging the Intelligence Committee to actually look into evidence of collusion between Clinton campaign associates, former FBI Director James Comey, and former Obama administration officials. Now, obviously, we know that there have been allegations, although there is no evidence as to whether or not this is true, but allegations of collusion between Trump campaign associates and Russian government officials. But Page is sort of flipping that on its head and really emboldening the committee to investigate evidence of collusion between the Clinton campaign, Comey, and former Obama administration officials.
I can understand why Democrats wouldn't want to broaden the investigation necessarily into that area. But what about Republicans on the committee? I know the intelligence committees are structured in a slightly different way and are generally more bipartisan than the other committees in Congress. Do you get the sense there's growing interest in that, or are they trying to tackle one aspect of surveillance and possible collusion at a time?
Well, it certainly seems like the intelligence committees, both in the House and the Senate, are really focusing right now on the investigation into Russia's meddling in the election. I mean, we have just seen a barrage of information being reported from various news agencies that all relate to the investigation. Now, obviously, the committees, not to my knowledge, have indicated they have not indicated that they are going to sort of shift gears and include former Obama administration officials. But as we're seeing just this flood of leaks come out, it seems like the committees are sticking with looking into Russia's meddling in the election.
Let me ask you about a couple other aspects in our remaining couple of minutes here. We're talking to Melissa Quinn of the Washington Examiner, the breaking news editor there. One of the other developments that's happened over the past few weeks was the recalcitrance of Michael Flynn to participate either in testimony or handing over documents. He has now changed his mind, at least as I can tell, on with respect to the documents. What is the significance of that going forward?
Well, Flynn is one of, I think it's four total, former Trump campaign officials, people who worked in an official capacity and then also in an informal capacity with the campaign. Now, just like you said, he was actually subpoenaed for documents related to his business dealings a few weeks ago. And as we know, he pled the fifth. But in addition to Flynn, the intelligence committees have requested documents and information from Carter Page, Paul Manafort, and Roger Stone, who really served as an informal advisor to Trump specifically. And all three of those gentlemen have all said that they're obviously, as we've seen from Carter Page's comments, cooperating with the committees and are handing over the relevant documents that they're asking for.
When it comes to where people on Capitol Hill think this investigation is right now, it's kind of head scratching. We mentioned former CIA Director John Brennan. He said he's not aware of any evidence of collusion. James Clapper, the former Director of National Intelligence, has said the same thing, although both of them said it's not impossible that it happened. They're just not aware of it. And yet we have folks like Al Franken saying everything points to collusion. So is this mainly political posturing? Do they think they smell blood? Are they just praying that there's blood out there somewhere? How does this actually shake out right now?
Well, you're right. It certainly seems like Democrats are sort of have their ears perked up about what's going on. But just like you said, Republicans on Capitol Hill and also former intelligence officials, as you mentioned, are saying that they have not seen any evidence of collusion at all between the Trump campaign and Russian officials. And some Democrats have said that as well. But I think the other side to this that is also important is that Democrats are actually alleging as well that we could potentially be seeing that there was potential obstruction of justice on the part of President Trump related to his conversations with former FBI Director James Comey. Now, obviously, I think that's a really important point, is that right now there is no evidence of collusion, and that is something that has been confirmed repeatedly by former intelligence officials, and I think that's a point that often gets lost in this discussion.
Timetable is a word we often use in Washington, probably more often than we should on various things, because obviously the ultimate goal is to get it right, then get it quickly. But given that the fact that we're now over 4 months into the Trump administration and we still don't have a single person interviewed by the House Intelligence Committee, is it safe to assume that this is going to drag on for a very long time? Or once they get the ball rolling here, will some of these interviews start to happen pretty quick?
I think we'll just have to see. Like I mentioned earlier, former FBI Director James Comey was basically given the green light from Robert Mueller, who is the special counsel on this case, appointed by the Justice Department a few weeks ago, to go ahead and testify publicly. I think a lot of Republicans and Democrats also thought it was a good sign that the Justice Department decided to appoint to name a special counsel to lead this investigation. But again, like you said, everything says it remains to be seen as to whether or not these interviews and testimonies will actually take place.
Yeah, timetable's a one that we hear a lot. Time will tell is another one that we hear a lot, and I guess that's the operative word as it pertains to these committees. Melissa, fantastic reporting. Thanks so much for bringing us up to speed. We appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much.
Melissa Quinn, breaking news editor for the Washington Examiner on Behind the Curtain. I'm Greg Corumbus, filling in for Jack Berkman. When we come back, a look, a very early look at the 2018 midterms, and still to come, the White House staff shakeup. Is it really all that important? And what shakeup looked like? And we'll also take a look at Olympic venues in deterioration and why cities no longer really even want the problem. We'll be right back.
All the stories and controversies that no one talks about, but everyone should know about.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
Behind the Curtain with Jack Berkman.
Greg Corumbus filling in for Jack Berkman this week. I am the news director at Radio America and the co-host of the Three Martini Lunch, which you can find at Blog Talk Radio and Ricochet and National Review. For the next few minutes, we're going to be taking a close look at the 2018 midterm elections. And hopefully you haven't turned off your radio or television yet. I know we just had an election. It was barely 6 months ago, and there was plenty of drama leading up to it. And quite frankly, the intensity of the campaign has only gotten stronger since Donald Trump won and since he became president of the United States back in January. Nonetheless, a lot of people in Washington, and certainly both parties, are already well focused on 2018. So what does the early landscape look like? A lot of folks think you can draw early and definitive conclusions from some of these special House races that have popped up as a result of President Trump nominating existing members of Congress to serve in his administration. He named Mike Pompeo, the former Kansas congressman, to be CIA director. That race to replace him resulted in a much closer conclusion. The Republican did win the seat, but it was only by a handful of points in a seat that Mike Pompeo won by 30 points back in November. Democrats like to point out the fact that this means there's a groundswell of support, even in a deep red district. That's probably not actually the case, because the new congressman, Congressman Estes, was very closely aligned with Kansas Governor Sam Brownback. And while Sam Brownback is a conservative, he is deeply unpopular in Kansas, due to the fact that a lot of his economic programs have not worked well, and other people are disappointed with some of the other programs that he has initiated and haven't quite materialized as the governor promised. So there's a lot of brownback baggage with that particular nominee, and that dragged into the general election. And still, the Democrats were unable to win a race, although it was much closer than expected. Then, of course, there's the body slam race. That's the Montana race where Greg Gianforte was able to beat Rob Quist on May 25th. That's also a pretty deep red district, but it's not one that Democrats can't win. It's kind of an independent streak in Montana, and sometimes that bleeds over into the Democratic side of the race. Ultimately, Gianforte, despite the incident, the encounter, the physical confrontation with the reporter the day before the election, was able to win by about 7 points. Still, Democrats see a silver lining. Republicans, of course, are saying if you can't beat a guy who was charged with assault the very day before the election, you might not want to be seeing too many silver linings in that race. The big one coming up, of course, is in Georgia. That's where John Ossoff, who barely missed winning that race in the first primary round, is matching up with Republican Karen Handel. Latest polls are fairly close, but one had Ossoff up 7. That's a deep red district, or at least has been until recent redistricting. Health Secretary Tom Price held that seat until he, of course, was confirmed as secretary. But that's a seat also held by former House Speaker Newt Gingrich, going all the way back to the late 70s. Democrats haven't won it in a very long time. Nonetheless, we'll see going forward how much anti-Trump sentiment, whether that builds a fervor in the Democratic base, means for the midterm elections. A lot of folks believe if they're going to take over one House of Congress next year, and it's very early to say so, that it'll probably be the House, because there are a number of swing districts. They would need to win about 20 net to take over the majority, and that could pretty much stifle the Trump agenda. But a lot of things would have to go right. And given the fact that there aren't that many votes on the record yet for these Republican lawmakers outside of the House version of the American Health Care Act, probably going to be difficult to build a case against them. But if there's a national tide against a Republican president and a lot of Republican House members are on the ballot because they hold the majority, that could be big trouble. Senate side is interesting. You would think that with only a 2-seat majority that Republicans would have difficulty perhaps holding on. And they're going to have a couple of tight races there. You've got Dean Heller trying to win re-election in Nevada, which is a state that has trended bluer and bluer in recent years. And that's going to be very difficult for Republicans to hold. We don't know yet who's going to be the Democratic nominee, but you have to think if Republicans might lose a seat, it could be that one. Republicans aren't super happy, especially conservatives, with Jeff Flake in Arizona. He has not been the rock-rib conservatives that a lot of people think. Democrats have yet to officially field a strong challenger to Flake, though. There is a Republican challenger, but at this point, it's pretty safe to assume Flake will be the nominee. When it comes to the rest of the map, 2012 was a really good year for Democrats, which means they've got a lot of seats to defend, and it means Republicans don't have that many. 7, in fact. 7 out of 33 seats is all that the Republicans have to defend, and those are in deep red states for the most part. Other than Nevada and potentially Arizona, you've got Ted Cruz running for re-election in Texas. You've got Mississippi and Alabama seats open. You've also got Tennessee open. Senator Corker might be retiring. There are some rumors to that effect, but it certainly seems that Republicans would hold that seat in any case. Also, Utah and Wyoming. So Republicans don't have a lot of very tough battles, even if the sentiment against President Trump is pretty darn strong. Holding the Senate should not be that difficult of a problem for Republicans. On the Democratic side, they got a lot of seats to defend, and some of them in deep red states that Trump won by quite a bit. Heidi Heitkamp, North Dakota, Claire McCaskill, Missouri. You've got John Tester out in Montana, and even some of the Rust Belt states. Sherrod Brown could be in trouble in Ohio, especially when you figure that the Democrats there are so starved for talent that they're recruiting Jerry Springer to run for governor of Ohio. So that's just a quick look at 2018. There's a long way to go. Anything can happen. Momentum can change in a heartbeat. But we'll be keeping a close eye on it here on Behind the Curtain, of course, and be reporting as events warrant. Still to come on Behind the Curtain, we'll be right back looking at the White House staff shakeup. And after that, why Olympic venues are in ruins and cities don't want to host anymore.
Where everything is depicted as a Washington Post political cartoon.
Behind the Curtain with Jack Berkman.
We're back on Behind the Curtain. I'm Greg Corumbus filling in for Jack Berkman. Still to come in this edition of Behind the Curtain, we'll take a look at why Olympic venues so quickly deteriorate and why that blight on the landscape of these cities is really an eyesore on the Olympic legacy at this point, and why that and other headaches often lead to the conclusion in some of these cities that even trying to host these games is no longer really worth it. So are we seeing perhaps the fading out of the Olympics as a prestige event for major cities around the world? We'll get into that with Stephen Malanga of the Manhattan Institute in just a few minutes. But right now we're going to talk about another soap opera, and that is the situation at the White House. We saw a little bit of a shakeup earlier this week when the communications director for President Trump decided to resign after just 3 months on the job. But much more is expected to come, maybe at press secretary, maybe other positions inside the West Wing, including counselors whose names we hear a lot but don't necessarily hear from them directly very often. With me now to talk about is Jeff Cruer, author and political analyst. And Jeff, thanks very much for being with us.
Hey, Greg, thanks for having me.
Well, it wouldn't be a day in Washington in the Trump administration without a little political intrigue and a little palace intrigue here. Let's start with the news that we actually know, and that is the resignation of the communications director. This is not a name that a lot of folks were familiar with. It's not somebody who was prominent in the foreground of the Trump administration's communication strategy. So is this significant only in that changes are happening, or is this a major move in and of itself?
Well, I mean, we could see some other moves. The communications director position now might be one that the president might select from within his staff and shuffle some people around. Let's say Sean Spicer gets that position and someone moves into press secretary. So maybe there'll be some reshuffling among his current staff. I would prefer to see him bring on some new blood. I think the position requires a very aggressive, very articulate press secretary. I think we have seen Sean Spicer. I think he's a good person. I think he's tried hard. But I think we need someone who really is ready for battle, because the media is 89% opposed to Donald Trump. The coverage has been 89% negative. It is really a war, and I think it really calls for someone who can articulate his case and really go toe-to-toe with all these negative media outlets that you see at the press briefing every time. Either that or just cut back or eliminate these press briefings, because I don't know what good they're really doing the president.
Jeff, you laid out the criteria pretty thoroughly. Do you have any specific names in mind?
Listen, I've seen some people on TV and radio that I think are good people. I've heard names such as Laura Ingraham as a possibility, others who are on, Kimberly Guilfoyle, who's on Fox, and
yeah, she's been
others
mentioned.
as maybe filling that role. I'm not sure, but I just have not been impressed by what I've seen so far. It seems like the media sort of runs all over Sean Spicer, and I just don't think that's the best way to protect the president. And it's really been an onslaught ever since he was elected. It's been negative. They've been trying to trap the president and everything. They want to focus on the Russia issue to the exclusion of everything else. So I think time is right to make some changes.
Will a different person at the podium, even if they're more competent in some of those areas we've talked about, make a difference, since the media's strategy towards the president probably won't change much?
I think they need not only a new person, but a new strategy. I think we need to see a different type of press briefing, maybe one that is based on international reporters one day, maybe business reporters another day, maybe local reporters another day. Not just giving the same old critics from CBS, ABC, NBC, CNN, MSNBC a chance to bash the president every day and ask about Russia. I mean, that's all they're interested in. I mean, I was bemused at the last Meet the Press. The president had his whirlwind trip. We had terror attacks. We had all the business from Congress. And they spent the entire program talking about Russia. So it was as if the president didn't go overseas. It was as if ISIS didn't attack Manchester, England. I mean, it's amazing. So I think they need to – I know the president's bringing on sort of a team to help him deal with that internally. But I think he needs externally aggressive help to take on this media.
What about the president himself in terms of messaging? He's been criticized by some, even on the right, about suggesting different things, whether it's through Twitter or offhand comments, perhaps during television interviews, that seem to contrast with something else he said on that general issue. What advice do you have for him for either whether it's staying on message or greater clarity in how he expresses himself? What steps could he take, perhaps?
Well, I mean, I think there needs to be better coordination between the president and his team, because many times he'll tweet something which will contradict what his press secretary said. So they seem to not be on the same page, or someone else from his administration. So there is a real problem there. I think you're right. I generally like his Twitter because I think it's a way for the president to communicate with the American people unfiltered, and I think that's important, especially in this media environment that we're in. But any little hiccup, any little contradiction, the media is going to jump all over it. So he needs to make sure he's totally consistent in his messaging, and that's one of the reasons why I haven't been really satisfied with what I've seen so far from his communication staff.
What about deeper in the West Wing? And I guess I'm referring specifically to his closest circle of advisors. We hear a lot of unsourced reporting about the drama and the tension there, whether it's between Steve Bannon and Reince Priebus, Steve Bannon and Jared Kushner, and all sorts of other potential relationships there. There's always rumors that somebody's about to go. The latest round involves Priebus, and there's already allegedly jockeying who would be the next chief of staff and so forth. So it's hard to know exactly what's happening there, but we know that there are different factions of Republicans and conservatives inside the West Wing. I mean, Reince Priebus and Steve Bannon probably weren't golfing buddies before they got together in helping Donald Trump get elected and then run this administration. So is this, to use the term, team of rivals working for him? Is it not working? Does it need to be tweaked? Or what do you think there?
No, I agree. I've heard ever since his administration started rumors about somebody getting the axe. It was Bannon. Now it's Priebus. Before that, it was Kellyanne Conway. I mean, it's a never-ending stream of rumors. So, yeah, I think he does sort of have a little team of rivals type of setup there, because Priebus and Bannon are not from the same wing of the party. Of course, Jared Kushner comes in from a totally different perspective. And I think that's sort of a good thing, to get different input, and then the president make his decision, which is sort of like Ronald Reagan did. He had, you know, Deaver and Meese and Baker giving him different opinions from different wings of the party, of ideology, and then he would make a decision. And I think that could serve the president well. The problem is, I think, is a lot of these leaks. Somebody or a multitude of people there are just talking nonstop to the media, and that is very harmful to the president, very harmful to the country. So that is something he's got to address pronto. We've got to find out who is doing the leaking, because that is that's not only harmful to his administration, but it's illegal. Some of this is going on, and they need to get to the bottom of that very, very soon.
How do you root that out? There's obviously a lot of different people, I'm sure, that are passing through there, different people that are listening to the close circle of advisors that probably have his direct ear. So it could be coming from just about any number of sources from inside the West Wing. So based on your experience, what's the best way to ferret out who the problem is here, or multiple people?
I think it's going to be up to the Justice Department to maybe take the lead in trying to figure out where it's coming from. I think I would say it's probably some holdover staff, maybe from the Obama administration. So the best thing I would recommend the president is he needs to get his own people into all of these top positions as soon as possible. And I know that there's been a delay in really filling some of these open positions. The president hasn't filled some. So that's a problem. I mean, I think he needs to really work on getting his entire staff, key staff in place. And I think that'll help, because I think that's part of the problem. And I think you have this deep state, this bureaucracy, which really is in opposition to the president's agenda, which is sabotaging it. I mean, clearly they're sabotaging him. And they're trying to make his policies ineffective, and they're working with their friends in the media who also oppose the president's agenda. So he's up against all these different forces. He needs to have his team united, competent, aggressive, to be able to take all this on, and I think he could do a better job in putting this team together.
How urgent is it that he make these changes now? In other words, is there a absolute imperative that this gets done now, or can he ride this out a little longer?
No, I mean, I think it's imperative that he do it now. I mean, I think it's been going on too long. I think there's a lot of successes that the president has achieved in his first few months, but a lot of it's overwhelmed in all this noise and all this controversy and the leaks and this Russia obsession. So, yeah, I think it's time to shift the attention of the country to go on the offensive. And really, to do that, I think he's got to make some changes. And I'm hoping that this first step from the communications director resigning will lead to others, and that he'll bring in some new blood. But I guess we'll have to see. We've heard a lot of these rumors before about changes that never happen, but I'm just hoping this one turns out to be true.
Well, we'll certainly find out soon if the reporting is accurate. This is certainly a president who made his greatest fame by relieving people of their positions. So we'll see if he's ready to do that in the real world. Jeff, thanks very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Jeff Kruer is an author and political analyst. I'm Greg Corumbus, filling in for Jack Burton behind the curtain this week. When we come back, we'll take a look at the Olympics and why nobody really wants to be part of the hosting process anymore, and what happens to some of those host cities after all the athletes and fans go home. We'll be right back.
All the stories and controversies that no one talks about, but everyone should know about.
Why don't you get a toupee with some brains in it?
Behind the Curtain with Jack Berkman.
We are Behind the Curtain. I am not, however, Jack Berkman. I'm Greg Corumbus, filling in for Jack this week. I am the news director at Radio America and the co-host of the Three Martini Lunch, which you can find at nationalreview.com. You can also find it at Ricochet or Blog Talk Radio. I'm joined now by Stephen Malanga, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, to talk about an issue that gets attention every 2, maybe 4 years, and that's the Olympics. And we're not talking about who's going to be going for gold in the 2018 Winter Olympics. We're talking about whether any city's soon going to want to host these games, either winter or summer, and why these cities that furiously work to complete the venues for swimming and arenas and track and field stadiums and so many other things basically let them rot in waste in their cities and just basically add to the overall blight. So what are the economics of this? And is the idea of major world cities hosting the Olympics starting to fade a little bit? Stephen, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Well, the kickoff for this particular look behind the curtain at the Olympics and the rationale, both political and economic, for it is that we're seeing reports already that some of the key venues for the Rio de Janeiro summer games from 2016 are already falling into disrepair. They're basically neglected, and they're turning into eyesores in a city that a lot of folks believe probably never should have been allowed to host the games in the first place. So this probably doesn't surprise you too much that it happens in Rio, but we know that it happens in a lot of other cities that have hosted as well, whether it's Beijing or Athens or certainly Sarajevo, but they've got extenuating circumstances perhaps in that situation. Why is it that so many of these cities that work so hard and spend so much money to bring these games to their cities just basically ignore that infrastructure once the games are done?
Well, one of the things is that the Olympics, especially the Summer Olympics, require so many different venues that ultimately you have to build things. And the thing is, what happens is, in order to justify the cost of the Olympics, essentially what cities do, or sometimes national governments like China, really, it wasn't really Beijing that hosted the Olympics, it was really China. What they do is to justify this, they said, well, we're going to build this stuff and it's going to be infrastructure later on. That happens in the United States, too. You hear this all the time. New York City, when it made its bid a decade ago, did the same thing, talked about, you know, using a stadium, building a stadium that the Jets were later going to use in New York City. The thing is, that is basically a bunch of baloney. A lot of these sites never get reused. You have to build them to, I mean, you have to be a fantastic urban planner to build all these sites and anticipate the actual usage later on, and then some way or another have some kind of structure or some kind of organization that actually organizes people and you know, to use these sites, you know, because a lot of them are sports venues, and it never happens. So, you know, you were talking about Rio, but you can, if you go online and you basically Google, you know, abandoned Olympic venues, you can see photo shoots from around the world. So every Olympics, you know, Athens, going back to Montreal, the Olympics, which it almost broke, essentially, the city of Montreal, as they were indebted for years. This is something that you see around the world. It's not shocking. And cities haven't seemed to learn, in part because everyone thinks that this is going to make them, or maybe, you know, there's a certain energy that comes with announcing we've got the Olympics, which later disappears.
So, you know, we often see these issues popping up with professional sports teams in the United States, and they make the argument for why a new stadium is warranted, and oftentimes taxpayer dollars are involved. It probably varies exactly how these get funded from country to country and Olympics to Olympics. But is it essentially the pro sports stadium argument on steroids, that this is going to be this fantastic venue that can be used for all these different things, and then it just never ends up turning out that way?
Well, that's exactly right. First of all, let's talk about the pro sports argument. Many, many studies done by independent researchers after the fact, in other words, not these projections would say, if we build a stadium or this arena downtown, it's going to be, we're going to make all this money. And many studies that are actually done after these things are built by, you know, nonpartisan neutral observers clearly show that they don't begin to pay for themselves. And they don't begin to pay for themselves because they generate basically a lot of low-wage service jobs. They're often seasonal jobs. They're part-time jobs. The actual economic impact turns out to be very small. We see this over and over and over again. There are very few examples. You can find maybe a few where stadiums are built, like in downtown areas, that help a revival of the downtown. Maybe you could argue Camden Yards would be an example of that. Certainly Camden Yards in Baltimore had a big impact on the downtown Baltimore area, but even that didn't revive the Baltimore economy. It remains an economically troubled city. So that's the argument in general against these facilities. Now, when you add the Olympics, you have the kind of temporary nature of what they're doing is amplified, because you're building like maybe 10 times as much as just a simple stadium.
For 2 weeks.
You're going to be using it only once. And then it's gone, you know. And the argument always is, well, it'll bring tourists and it'll reintroduce the world to us, and the economic benefits will reverberate through the years. They never reverberate to that extent that they can actually pay for these massive investments.
And so the trend here now is, you used to have American cities and European cities, they'd have to basically have a early bracket to find out who the American nominee would be, and then Europe would figure out its nominee, Asia would figure out its nominee. Looking at 2024, and that's the next games to be picked here, there's only two cities around the world, one of them's here, Los Angeles, the other is Paris, who even want to host the games at this point. And obviously there's a little bit of time before that decision is made, but does that suggest to you that cities are wising up, that despite the allure that supposedly comes with hosting the Olympic Games, that the bottom line just proves that it's not worth it?
Well, I would say, first of all, that it's residents and voters who are wising up. And essentially public officials who still love, you know, introducing this stuff and cutting ribbons are only being dragged along reluctantly. In New York City, it was the tremendous antipathy to the games, even as the city itself and the mayor at the time, Mayor Bloomberg, organized all his energies to try to get this done. It was the tremendous antipathy to the games among the residents that essentially caused the city not to win the games. After that, you know, you've had Chicago. The planning in Chicago, it was another example of what they were claiming the games were going to bring was fantastic, and nobody bought into it, and ultimately it didn't win the games. Boston started, you know, a movement. They were the next city, but there's been tremendous opposition in Boston, and it's that movement basically just dissipated. Los Angeles is making the argument that because they've had the games before and they have all these facilities and they know how to do it, they can do it cheaper than anyone, and it makes sense for them to do it. And they may be closer to the mark, because the big problem has been these cities that have never had the games, and the whole idea is we're going to build a whole infrastructure and it's going to influence our building and change the landscape of the city, you know, and that's all going to be great. Those are probably the worst case scenarios.
So is it that idea, previous host cities that haven't let their facilities fall into complete disrepair, perhaps becoming a shorter rotation for who hosts the games, or maybe, like you mentioned with Beijing, a team of cities essentially trying to do this?
Right.
So maybe you have the opening ceremonies in one city, but various cities around the U.S., if the U.S. were to do it, for example, could host different things with venues that are already there, which lead to obviously far less infrastructure necessary beforehand.
Well, you see, I think that's the next phase, and it's being driven by necessity. And this is true, first of all, not only in the Olympics, but the other very big every four-year world event is the World Cup in soccer,
right,
which requires huge facilities and often a lot of building. And the thinking for both the Olympics for years and also for the World Cup was always that these organizations, we want to move it around, we want to give different countries an opportunity, and particularly we want to give less developed countries an opportunity because this is going to be good for them. And that's proven to be exactly the opposite of what's happened. It's been bad for them. So now the trend is actually going in the other direction, which is let's, you know, revisit the places that have done this, the places like the United States that have the capacity to do this. The United States is also the leading bidder, actually I should say North America, but mostly the United States, for the 2026 World Cup, which would be held in the United States, but also partially in Canada and Mexico. It's really more, you know, but the whole idea is they already have the stadiums. Unlike Brazil, they don't have to build them. We have more professional stadiums, you know, in America. So now
right,
suddenly it's a kind of a reverse of this, you know, let's give it to the less developed countries. Let's have it everywhere.
Steve,
that's actually a big burden.
We've got to run. Thanks so much for your time today. Steve Malanga, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. This is Behind the Curtain. I'm Greg Corumbus in for Jack Berkman. I am the news director at Radio America. You can check out the Three Martini Lunch, which I co-host, at National Review Online or Ricochet or Blog Talk Radio. Thanks for being with us this week. So long.